When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Plays the Thing. Before we get into today's episode, I have recorded this kind of preface to the first of the Coriolanus episodes because we recorded it on Shakespeare's birthday, but we didn't realize it until after we had recorded the show. So Sarah Jane Bentley, who joins me on the Plays the Thing for Coriolanus, sent me an email after we got done recording, and she said, oh no, it's the Bard's birthday, and we completely forgot. So thankfully, our editor, Logan, has added this on to the beginning of the show, and we just want to say happy birthday to the Bard. He was born on this day, April 23rd, 1564, in Stratford-upon-Avon in England, 456 years ago, and we are still reading and recording about him today. Hope you enjoy the show.
What's the matter, you dissentious rogues that rubbing the poor itch of your opinion make yourselves scabs?
We have ever your good word.
He that will give good words to thee will flatter beneath abhorring. What would you have, you curs, that like nor peace nor war? The one affrights you, the other makes you proud. He that trusts to you, where he should find you lions, finds you hares, where foxes, geese. Who deserves greatness, deserves your hate.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Plays the Thing. That was Ralph Fiennes from the 2011 movie Coriolanus. I am Tim McIntosh, and I am joined by Sarah Jane Bentley. Sarah Jane, welcome back to the show.
Tim, it's so nice to be back. I haven't heard those words for such a long time. Welcome to the Plays the Thing.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious if anything has happened, you know, of significance in your life since you were last on the show.
Well, there was one thing, yeah.
Something.
So I had a baby on the 7th of January. Yeah. Elizabeth is 4 months old now, nearly.
How's Elizabeth doing?
She's a delight.
Is she really?
Yeah, she smiles a lot. She sleeps really well. Mums will understand that sleeping through the night is a big deal. And she's very good at sleeping. She eats really well. They're very simple things, but they mean a lot. So, yeah, she's great.
And how's Mom doing? Elizabeth's your first.
Yeah, I've certainly changed my priorities, my perspective. Everything is different now.
Really?
I never was kind of prepared for how different things would be in a really good way.
Yeah.
It's great. So it's exciting. I mean, there's a whole life here in my arms and I'm responsible.
Yeah.
Which is pretty incredible.
And she's there right now.
She's here.
She started working on memorizing any of the sonnets. I mean,
we've been doing the Psalms, You've been memorizing short bits of the psalms, verses here and there. Yeah, but
I was kidding.
I'm sure when she starts to talk, they'll just be in there. No, I'm not kidding.
when she starts to speak, it'll be King James English that she speaks in.
That's what we all speak, more or less, isn't it? one thing happened that was such an amazing surprise. I think it was probably about week 8 of Elizabeth's life,
yeah.
And this parcel arrived out of the blue, and it had these very beautiful muslins in it, which were Harry Potter themed, and they're from an anonymous sender. And it just said Jocko's So I emailed David and said, is this from you? Because it's from the States. And he said, oh, no, we have this group of really friendly and kind listeners who do special things for us. And no sooner had I figured that out, about a week later, then we had this beautiful Folio Society book of poetry for children arrive as well. So it was... we were thoroughly spoiled by your listeners. It was amazing. And we're really grateful.
Sarah Jane, I wish I could say that I was surprised by that, but it's just, it's the way that they are. Heidi and I and David and I have talked so often off the air. It's like, what? We don't deserve this.
No.
It's really incredible. Remarkable. It's such a, it's just so wonderful. I remember one time I had a student leave me, hello Elizabeth. I had a student, like, I think they literally brought an apple to class, like the old cliche. It was a beautiful apple, and they had like thought of me while they were grocery shopping and brought me an apple. And just that little apple was so meaningful to me. And now the Jocose readers just kind of shower us with gifts. Muslim.
And apparently. So thoughtfully chosen as well. You know, all literary, very beautiful.
Yeah.
And such an amazing surprise.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Speaking of our listeners, I did a little poll last night, and this is going to transition us into our play. I did a little poll on the Facebook page last night. Okay. And I asked the readers a series of questions. Basically, I asked, how familiar are you with this play? And so I gave them a variety of options, like never read it, never seen a production. I, you know, only know its name from the table of contents in my Shakespeare anthology. I've read it, but I've never seen it. I've seen it, but I've never read it. So I gave them a whole host of different options. I think by the time I clocked in to do the show, there were over 200 response. And I did the math, and basically, Sarah Jane, 80% of the people on the Close Reads Facebook page have no acquaintance with Coriolanus aside from the name. And I was not a bit surprised by that. So one of the things that I want to talk about kind of at the top of the show on our, you know, during the first act is you and I love this play. Like, I mean, I love this play. This is one of the best things he ever wrote, and it's Shakespeare. And this play, even though it's like one of like the top plays in the canon, is almost unknown by people who, like our readers, that are quite knowledgeable about the canon. They like Shakespeare. They follow the plays, the thing. And I think they're not alone. People just don't know this play. And so my opening question for you is, how do you explain the kind of gap between the quality of the work and its relative anonymity? Why don't people know this play better?
Perhaps one reason is that the language of this play is a bit more challenging than some of the others. Mm-hmm. So a lot of plays are well known because they're chosen by schools, and perhaps your first encounter with Shakespeare might be when you're sort of 14, 15 at school. And this play, it doesn't have a love story, and the language is very political.
Yes.
And I think those, that in terms of its content, those are more mature themes, concerns, if you like. And so perhaps it's a play that you come to as an adult. And sadly, a lot of adults perhaps who weren't introduced to Shakespeare at school might never then come to Shakespeare.
Right.
That would perhaps be my hunch. And then I'm trying to think in terms of the cast, there are lots of good parts in it, aren't there? Probably some of the best parts for women in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I think Volumnia. So, yeah, it's not one of the kind of top of the pops type ones, is
right.
it? It's a bit more of an acquired taste, this one.
It is.
That's flattering us.
What do you mean? Wait, what do you mean it's flattering us?
Well, saying we've got an acquired taste for Shakespeare.
Well, no, I think that's true. It's part of your job. It's part of my job. I think it's true. I also wonder, I mean, in that opening clip that we heard from Ralph Fiennes, that's the first scene. And Ralph Fiennes basically steps out to an angry horde that wants corn, grain, and he tells them how much he hates them. And he does it, I mean, he spares no expense in insulting them, in telling them he just has no regard for them whatsoever. And so I think about someone like Coriolanus as compared to someone like Macbeth. Both of these are tragedies. But even Macbeth at the beginning of the play, there's something very compelling about him. He's a great warrior, but he's married. He seems to love his wife. He has a great friend in Banquo, and there's a real humanity to him that's very appealing. Whereas Coriolanus from the opening whistle is almost barbaric in his egotism. He does not like the plebes.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, we have the Romantics to thank, really, for the popularity of Shakespeare. There was a huge kind of resurgence of interest in, well, Hamlet, for example, because of Coleridge. Mm. And you're right, there isn't a lot you can romanticize about Coriolanus, because for us moderns, really, and if we think the early modern period started in the 1600s, the warrior whose main objective is valor is not a kind of fashionable concern. What we want are flawed heroes, lovers, and Coriolanus just doesn't fit that.
We just got done doing As You Like It, Heidi and I did, and I thought Coriolanus is almost the anti-type of Orlando. If you remember Orlando who No, it's fine. I kind of like it, Sarah Jane. I mean, it's like, it's real life.
It is real life. I don't know if it's what your listeners are going to want. But you were saying Orlando and Coriolanus are...
Orlando strikes me as the opposite. He's almost like the anti-type of Coriolanus. He's hanging poetry on the trees. Yeah, I mean, he does fight, but even in the fight that he has in the wrestling match in Act One, he wins by chance, almost by pure chance. He happens to throw this great wrestler and he wins. But all the descriptions of him are, he is kind of, I love it. All the descriptions of him are about his slight frame. He's not a warrior. He's just the opposite of Coriolanus. So, Sarah Jane, I'm just going to give a brief overview of the play. I'm going to presume that some of the people that are listening have probably, like, they're curious about this play, and maybe they're going to use Act One to kind of get them into the play. So, here is the basic cursory outline of the play. Coriolanus is a great warrior. The time is the Roman Republic. So, the very top of the play, there are Russian mobs that are begging for corn. They're starving. They're begging for corn. And Menenius, one of the consuls of the Republic, meets them and tells them a story, which I think I'm going to, like, we can dwell on that. Hey, there's Elizabeth. I don't know if everybody can, we're probably not going to have the video, but everybody, I get to see Elizabeth. She's smiling at me. She looks really happy. She's beautiful. And I'm going to tell her a little bit about Menenius. He's a consul for the Roman Republic. And he's kind of in this situation where he's really good friends with Coriolanus. And he needs to kind of like draw the peace. But in the middle of this rabble, storming the gates, attempting to get corn, our hero shows up, Caius Marcius. So he's not yet Coriolanus. He's Caius Marcius. He shows up, and from that clip that we heard in the opening, the very top of the show, he despises, absolutely despises the lower classes of Rome. He has no tolerance for them. And there's a kind of, he thinks in terms of, if Rome is going to be great, you people cannot be great. You're kind of the enemy of the greatness of Rome. The play progresses, and soon Coriolanus, Caius Marcius, is sent out to defend Rome against their great enemies at Corioli, in which he does battle with Aufidius, who is his arch enemy. Coriolanus is injured in the battle, but he wins the battle. And he returns home to the Senate. The Senate praises him, thanks him. You have triumphed over our enemies. We were so worried. We couldn't have done it without you. Thank you so much. You deserve honors. You really deserve honors. But now, and this is a key part of the play, to achieve these honors, Coriolanus, who's now been called Coriolanus because he conquered at Corioli, so he's kind of given the names of his enemies in triumph, Coriolanus must humble himself, display himself and his injuries to the people in order to receive the honors from the Senate. He does this. He does not want to do this. He does not feel like he should lower himself to the approval of the plebs because he's one of the greats. They're the crows. He's an eagle. Why would I lower myself to them? He does it anyway. The representatives of the plebs take this as an opportunity to kind of subvert him. He is cast out of Rome. And then in a great twist, Coriolanus is so angry at Rome that he goes to his enemies, joins with Aufidius, his arch enemy, and is prepared to march on Rome when, so this is the spoiler alert. If you don't want to know what happens at the conclusion of the play, you need to fast forward about 30 to 60 seconds. Menenius dispatches Coriolanus's mother, wife, son, and a friend to meet him on the road to Rome and to beg for mercy. And we have already met Volumnia, his mother. We've already met his wife, his son, and their friend. But the relationship between Volumnia and Coriolanus is one of the more interesting ones for me in all of Shakespeare. It's a little bit bizarre. And he seems to have more affection for his mother than he does. He loves his wife, but he seems to have a stronger kinship and affection for his mother than he does with his wife. His mother, in one of the great speeches in the canon, his mother convinces him to turn back. And Aufidius, seeing that Coriolanus has been convinced by his mother to not march on Rome, feels betrayed. What does he do? He kills Coriolanus. The conclusion of the play is Coriolanus kind of, who has backed off out of his affection for his family, being killed by his archenemy after all. And it's a bloody play. And it's a violent play. And it's like the language is deeply complex, but that's where we are. So I want to ask you, this is my first question for you, Sarah Jane. What do you think of Coriolanus, our hero of the play?
He is, well, hard to like if we compare him to someone like Hamlet, for example. Personally, I absolutely love him because he loves the truth. And one of his great failings as a politician is that he's unable to lie convincingly. And he can only say, I think Menenius says of him something like his heart is his mouth. He can only say what he feels. He's he matches his words with deeds. So there's, in so many of Shakespeare's plays, there's this kind of tension between what a character says and what he does. But in Coriolanus, the two are one. He's completely unified in words and deeds. And that's really hard to bear because you're pelted with this missile, which is the truth, which is the hardest missile to be able to withstand. And he's always being told, you know, please, Coriolanus, can you just be a bit milder? You know, don't say what you think. Just smile and just bite your tongue. And he says, no, why would you have me be less of a man than the man I am? You brought me up to be like this. I am a child of Rome and I'm true to my nature. I can't be false to my nature. And so he's quite blunt in that sense. I find him really likable in that regard. And he's an interesting protagonist because he's dislikable and yet we can still sympathize with him. So the tragedy at the end is hard to judge whether he got what he deserved or whether he's been wronged.
Right.
And I think that makes it really fascinating as a character study. You know, was he manipulated by his mother or was this part of his kind of autonomous rebellion against the mother that brought him up, which is both Rome and Volumnia?
Right, right.
What are your thoughts about him?
I feel the exact same way. I love Coriolanus. I absolutely love this character. And I sometimes feel, I wonder if I should, because when he opens his mouth before the people, he's so full of venom. I mean, just so full of spite that I think, oh gosh, Coriolanus, I feel myself like Menenius, like milder, please, just a little bit milder. And it creates this kind of tension. This is, I think, the most, how do I say this? I think if you were a teacher and you want to try to see the main problems of a republic condensed and in a conflict-driven play, Coriolanus might be your play. Because there's this tension between the ruling class, the nobility, the aristocrats, and the lower classes. And Coriolanus absolutely refuses to he has a hard time humbling himself before them because he just doesn't respect them. He thinks that they are a canker. It's not just that they're not educated. It's not just that they don't have the sort of like skills that he has or the aristocrats has. No, he sees them as sort of a kind of a virus or a cancer that has the potential to erode the greatest state since Athens. I mean, he says so in the play. He says, this bench we're sitting at a greater bench than the one that was in Athens. So he sees the people as a great threat to that. And he does not mince words in telling them that that's what he thinks. So
no, that's right. He calls them he calls them fragments. He calls them curs. He compares them to rotting bodies. He calls them scabs. Uh-huh. He's so full of vitriol. You're right.
So much.
But why do you think that is? What does he have against them? I think it's that, as he says, they didn't fight for Rome when they were called to, and now they want corn gratis. They want free corn.
Right.
Because why should the city provide for you when you did nothing for your city?
Yeah.
And this is the very difficult paradox in the play, is that Coriolanus, the play says the people are the city.
Uh-huh.
And Coriolanus hates the people, uh-huh, but he loves Rome. Uh-huh. So what does he actually love?
Right. Right.
Okay. It's a very interesting...
Let me ask a question. If the people had not abdicated their duty and they had gone to fight, or let's just say that the people were not under threat and there was no call to arms, do you think that Coriolanus, from what you know about his character in the play, do you think that Coriolanus would still despise them in the way that he despises them?
Yes, because the other thing he despises them for is them being fickle. He calls them Hydra. So it's like they have, 100 heads all saying different things. They're contradictory, and they can't rule themselves. They need to be ruled by an elite, is what he believes.
Right.
So I suppose those are the two things from the play, I think, that he hates about the people. The one is that they didn't fight. And the second is that they're all words, but they're just kind of whirling words that contradict.
Yes.
They change their minds all the time. And he thinks that his reasons are superior to theirs. So it's really, the play really looks at some of the weaknesses of a democratic system.
So I think part of the reason that this play is so compelling is that both my country and your country are in the middle of a kind of an upswell of populism. Our president and your prime minister both get called in the press, and I think probably accurately, they get called populists. And even though the arch enemy of Coriolanus in the play is Aufidius, the enemy's general, his deeper enemy is really these two representatives of the lower classes that have been given a spot on the Senate. And he thinks that they are sort of representatives of, they speak with a sort of popular mouth. And because they do, Coriolanus despises them because they kind of in some ways should know better. They at least they're in a position that they should know better. And I find that there's a twist late in the play that the two representatives of the popular of the people cast Coriolanus out of Rome. And then when they realize that he's marching on Rome, they absolutely relent and acknowledge his greatness after despising him the entire play. They turn back and they're like, yeah, he's as great as everybody says he was. And gosh, we need to do anything that we can to save our city because yeah, he's that kind of general and he's that kind of leader.
That's it.
Sarah Jane, one of the, I said earlier on that Aufidius is Coriolanus's arch enemy. But maybe it's actually these two tribunes that are the representatives of the people. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation because Coriolanus respects Aufidius. He's a lion that he's
very
proud to hunt.
Yeah.
But the tribunes he utterly disregards because he sees them as power seeking. He sees them as illegitimately seeking power because they haven't done anything for Rome to earn it. They have no cicatrices. They have no wounds on their body.
Right.
To show that they've slain the enemies of Rome. Shakespeare uses this really interesting metaphor of the tribunes as taking the channel of water of the people and running it into their own ditch for their own advantage.
Yeah.
That they can manipulate the power of the people and kind of wield it to their own advantage. And he doesn't see them at all as worthy of possessing this kind of power. And it's an interesting metaphor because at the time they were trying to get more water into London. And so it meant that the authorities had run roughshod over people's land to channel water through to feed the city. And kind of individual rights and perhaps very wealthy landowners weren't able to stand up against this. And Coriolanus is very much on the side of the elites. So he despises what would essentially be kind of MPs in Britain, elected members of parliament who basically have the voice of the people. What are they called in the US? Senators?
Yeah, traditionally the Senate, because it has longer terms, 6 years, is viewed as sort of like the upper house.
Yeah,
and the House
different.
Of Representatives, okay. Because it's 2 years, is viewed as the lower house. I think in the popular imagination, the two are kind of conflated today, but I think for the most part in American history, the Senate has been viewed as the upper house.
Yeah.
Closer to the House of Lords, maybe.
Yes, exactly. And closer to the senators in the play, the actual.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
Senators, yeah.
Yeah. Two more characters that I want to hear your thoughts on, Sarah Jane. Volumnia, the mother of Coriolanus, who we meet in the first act. She, oh my goodness, what a...
Tiger mom.
Exactly. So, can you describe her relationship to Coriolanus and what your impressions of her are?
Well, my first concern at the moment is to make sure that I'm not like her as a new mother.
Okay, what would tempt you to be like her? What would tempt you to be? Well, maybe we should talk about what she's like first.
I was proud to let him seek danger where he was like to find fame. I think my view of her is that she lives vicariously through her son. That as the Roman matron, it's not her duty to go out and fight for Rome, mm-hmm. although she would if she was allowed to. So she
and she'd probably be brings a up great warriors. Warrior.
She would. She says, yeah. Thy valiantness was mine, thou suckst it from me. She has molded this Martius, and he's aware of it. But that also makes her very vulnerable, because the moment he stops doing what she wants, she's lost all control of everything, because yeah. she's put everything into Martius. I think as a metaphor, Shakespeare might be playing with the idea that Volumnia is Rome, and that Rome is an overbearing mother mm-hmm. who sacrifices its own children. So at the end of the play, sorry, listeners, but the clue is in the title. When Coriolanus is sacrificed, it's what Volumnia wants.
Yes.
So there's this very strange sort of cannibalistic desire to the mother, both Volumnia and Rome. And it's a very harsh criticism of Roman society. And I think you find that quite often in Shakespeare's plays. He doesn't often portray Rome favorably.
So do you see a kind of parallel with Julius Caesar in this regard?
I don't know Julius Caesar, the play, that well, but in terms of Antony and Cleopatra, which I think he was writing mm-hmm. around about the same time as Coriolanus, you see Rome as this sort of uncompromising, very results-driven kind of society that just totally annihilates anything that stands in its way.
Right.
And there's a huge lack of gratitude. There's a lack of gratitude in Rome. The people yeah. are ungrateful to the leaders, and the leaders are ungrateful to the people. And I think that perhaps that might be the key to the play, ingratitude.
Okay, this is the ingratitude between the two classes makes me want to introduce our next character, Menenius. I have been tempted to make the case that Menenius is the actual hero of this play. He is on the Senate. He's a consul. And he shows up in the play before Coriolanus does. So he's the first to meet the people who are begging for corn, and he's calm and he's measured, and he in some ways kind of wins the people in the middle of their heat. He succeeds in kind of dialing down the heat. I want to play a long clip of him telling a story. The story is actually from Aesop, one of Aesop's fables, that he uses when the people show up at the gates demanding corn from the leaders of the Roman Republic. It's a longer clip, so everybody bear with us. And it's taken from an old Richard Burton production of Coriolanus, in which Richard Burton, the great, great Welsh actor with like the greatest voice of the 20th century. But having said that, I'm not gonna let you hear Richard Burton's voice until maybe a little bit like a subsequent podcast. So let's hear Menenius give his explanation about the relationship between the people and its leadership, or in his metaphor, the different parts of the body and the stomach, which is functionally the leader of the body.
I shall tell you a pretty tale. It may be you have heard it, but since it serves my purpose, I'll venture to tale a little more.
Well, I'll hear it, sir. Yet you must not think to pop off our disgrace with a tale. But I'm pleased to deliver,
There was a time when all the body's members rebelled against the belly, thus accused it. But only like a gulf, it did remain in the midst of the body, idle and inactive, still coveting the viand, never bearing like labor with the rest, where the other instruments did see and hear, devise, instruct, walk, feel, and mutually participate, did minister unto the appetite and affection common of the whole body. The belly answered.
Well, sir, what answer made the belly?
Sir, I shall tell you. With a kind of smile, which ne'er came from the lungs, but even thus, for look you, I may make the belly smile as well as speak. It tauntingly replied to the discontented members, the mutinous parts that envied his receipt, even so most fitly as you malign our senators, for that they are not such as you.
Your belly's answer. What? The kingly crowned head, the vigilant eye, the counselor heart, the armor soldier, a steed the leg, the tongue, a trumpeter with other muniments and petty helps in this our fabric, if that they...
What then? For me this fellow speaks. What then? What then?
Should by the cormorant belly be restrained, who is the sink of the body?
Well, what then?
The former agents, if they did complain, what could the belly answer?
I will tell you. If you'll bestow a small of what you have little patience about. Just hear the belly's answer.
You're wrong about it.
Note me this, good friend. Your most grave belly was deliberate, not rash, like his accusers. And thus answered. True is it, my incorporate friends, quoth he, that I receive the general food at first, which you do live upon. And fit it is, because I am the storehouse and the shop of the whole body. But if you do remember, I send it through the rivers of your blood, even to the court, the heart, to the seat of the brain, and through the cranks and offices of man, the strongest nerves, and small inferior veins from me receive that natural competency whereby they live. And though that all at once, you, my good friends, this set the belly, mark me.
Aye, sir, well, well.
Though all at once, cannot see what I do deliver out to each, yet I can make my audit up, that all from me do back receive the flower of all, and leave me but the bran. What say you to it?
It was an answer. How apply?
That was the actor Michael Hordern as Menenius Agrippa, a consul during the Roman Republic. So before we heard that clip, Sarah Jane, I suggest that maybe Menenius might be, he might be our kind of subtle hero in this play. And let me defend that. And then I'd like to hear what you think about the clip we just heard. If this play is about two rival parties, the lower classes in the aristocracy, who are unable to come to terms and recognize the value of each other, Menenius is the one. I mean, he's undoubtedly on the aristocratic, he's on the side of the aristocrats, and he is an aristocrat. But he is the one who kind of recognizes that statecraft requires getting both parties at the table. And he's the one that recognizes both parties have to kind of recognize the value of each other. They don't necessarily have to get along. They don't have to be good friends, but they've got to recognize the value of each other and kind of give each other the space that's due them in order for this republic to work. What do you think about Menenius? Is there any way that he could be kind of the background hero in the between these two rival factions?
I think he can be heroic in terms of the genre. He can't be the hero, but that's just a generic point.
Yeah.
But yeah, he does have heroic qualities in his statesmanship and his political ability, which is exactly what Coriolanus lacks. And I think the thing about Menenius is that he does understand the value of the relationship between the Senate and the plebeians, because what he understands is that they're mutually dependent, and the Senate hate that and the people hate that, but they can't survive without each other, because you don't need a Senate if there are no people.
Yeah.
And the people need to be governed. They need rule of law. They need, you know, the provision of justice and whatever else. So they hate the fact that they're mutually dependent. And this metaphor, the extended metaphor that Menenius talks about here, really illustrates that. But it's, I think there's a bit of a twist here, because he's sort of saying, look, the senators are this benign belly that smile, and they chew up all the corn, and we keep the chaff for ourselves, and we give you the best bits. We send it out through the veins to you, the people, the limbs. When actually what we see in the play is this belly, it eats the limbs and consumes everything. And it's actually smiling with this grave smile, which is like, you know what, I'm going to eat you too.
This sounds like it harkens back to kind of what you see as one of Shakespeare's complaints in Antony and Cleopatra, and also in this place. Maybe it's a complaint against Roman society at the time. Do you see that in his kind of reshaping, or in his telling of this tale and kind of omitting what the belly actually does? Is that what you see?
Yeah, I think that there's a subtle criticism going on here. I think Shakespeare's so brilliant. He's criticizing Rome because on the one hand he's saying, look, King James, my patron, England's so much better than Rome, and Rome was pretty great, England's better. But he's also saying to King James and to the people in the audience, look what happens in a society where Parliament and the people can't get on with the monarch. And Shakespeare's exploring this tension over corn at a time when in England there were corn riots, because the king had been greedy and had been requisitioning all kinds of goods from the people because he has this right of purveyance. And there were riots, and Parliament and the king could not get on. In fact, James had suspended Parliament for years, so it was impossible to even have the debate. So Shakespeare writes a play that shows us a hero who is identified with James, Coriolanus. James himself was instructed to speak mildly to Parliament.
I didn't know that.
That exact word, yeah.
That was, I did not know that. Given.
So it's very complex, isn't it? Because we see a hero who we think, wow, what a hero. But then we also feel sorry for the people who are being ridden over roughshod and whose needs and wants are being ignored. And so Shakespeare, at the same time as flattering James, is also sort of teaching a bit of a political lesson, saying, look, a democracy can't work if all sides aren't playing their part in the body.
Right, right.
And he does in the play manage to criticize James perhaps for being too profligate, but he also lionizes James for being, a man who's does what he wants,
right,
and true to his beliefs. So
I just can't help but hear the echoes of what's going on. I don't want to speak too much about what's going on in Britain, but I think of Boris Johnson and Donald Trump as these voices, regardless of what we think about them, that are intending to give voice to kind of like this large unknown body of people who feel like they've been sort of like shut out of the halls of power for a long time. And I just find this play is trying to address that same issue. And I think this is the problem of a republic or a democracy, is that the knife's edge of statesmanship is kind of like achieving some sort of, how do you say it? Some sort of peaceful regard between these two groups, the ruling class and the popular class, and trying to achieve that kind of like grace of balance between two classes that have nothing in common, that might as well be from two different countries, that don't really belong in the same country. They speak a different language.
The thing they have in common is that they all love Rome.
Yes, that's true. They all love Rome. Mm.
And that's what the thing that they have to remember. And that's the power of patriotism, I suppose.
Yes.
It's supposed to unite across all boundaries.
What's so interesting is, especially in the middle of this play, what Coriolanus thinks that Rome is and what the people think that Rome is are such different things. They're such different visions of kind of like the ideals of Rome. And that's where it begins to kind of like peel apart. Their rivalry begins to peel apart, and it becomes something that is ultimately kind of irreconcilable. That is a beautiful baby, Elizabeth. So listeners, sorry, I, Elizabeth was getting a little bit fussy, so her dad took her away for a little bit, and now she's back, and she's just such a little beauty. Maybe we should, like, I don't know, with your permission, I know we're all in kind of like corona shutdown. I don't really want anyone to see me in my current state, but it might be nice to get like a little snap of Elizabeth, because I think the Facebook
I can send you that. One. I'll send you one.
Okay. She's a beauty.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a kind of demagoguery about Boris Johnson and President Donald Trump that is obviously required if you're going to be elected.
Right.
And that, I think, is quite similar to someone like Absalom, David's son Absalom. The guy who could stand in the gate and say, hey, people, what are your grievances? Tell me and I'll go and I'll make the case for you and I'm going to put it right. And the thing that correlates
with Jane, I've never thought about Absalom as sort of like a popular demagogue. I've never thought that, but it absolutely fits, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he has great hair as well, like
yeah, Bojo, that's right. Right.
And President Trump, yeah.
So true.
But Coriolanus, of course, is not like that. He won't compromise on anything. He's got no finesse. I think this is why Fiennes portrays him so well, is that he portrays him as this like battle-hardened warrior who is dysfunctional whenever it's peacetime.
Yes.
Which is why he needs someone like Menenius as a father figure to be able to communicate what Coriolanus can't. Because Menenius clearly understands Coriolanus.
He does.
And is able to soften him a little. Coriolanus respects Menenius, and Menenius loves him, I think, as a son almost.
I think so.
It's interesting. I'm trying to think. In Plutarch, I think Volumnia has a husband who's still alive, but I think that Shakespeare really focuses on Volumnia and Coriolanus by getting rid of all her other children and wiping her husband out of the picture. So it becomes this really intense exploration of their relationship.
Which brings us to Aufidius. The lack of fathers in Shakespeare's play, to me, is this sort of glaring, or it's this very loud silence. And there's a way in which you can kind of read the play is that Coriolanus is on a quest to kind of please a father figure that's not present in the play. And in a strange way, his arch enemy on the battlefield, Aufidius, in a strange way, there's a fraternal kinship that they have that sometimes it's a little bit romantic in late act four or early act five. And it also sometimes seems like it's a kind of fatherly relationship that Coriolanus wants to have with Aufidius. What do you make of Aufidius, and what do you make of the relationship that he has with Coriolanus?
I think there's an extent to which we find it really hard to understand the relationship between two warriors who are peerless and are each other's nemesis, and to the extent that they want to fight each other to see who's going to win. So there are lots of metaphors in the play that compare the marriage bed to the battlefield, and Volumnia cultivates these quite a lot. So when Coriolanus crosses the threshold into Aufidius's kind of lair in Antium, he's welcomed like a bride.
Yes.
On the night of her wedding.
It's so strange to us,
but I wonder if in warrior culture that's kind of a parallel that they use, because they do love making war.
Yeah.
As much as they love making love. And there's lots of imagery like that in the play.
My friend Andrew likes mixed martial arts fighting, which in the U.S. is, I think it's the fastest growing sport in the U.S. And so
MMA.
I've watched a few fights with him. MMA.
Yeah.
Do you know MMA?
Oh, is it vegan?
Okay. If not for Andrew, I would never watch it, because I'm so empathetic that I put myself in the ring. I actually asked Andrew this. This is a total side note. I was watching a fight with Andrew, and I'm like,
the guys are getting ready to go at it, and it's going to be bloody and violent, and like one person has to tap out. That's how the fight ends, or you know, like hardly ever does it go the full five rounds. And I get so like I can feel my pulse increasing, and I'm like, Andrew, aren't you like nervous? The fight's about to start. And he's like, no, I'm not nervous at all. And I figured out it's because I really do put myself in the ring. Like I feel for like these two guys because I just empathize with them so much. I just feel the suffering that's about to happen. So I brought this up because at the end of the fights, there is a moment, and it happens in every fight, where these two warriors, bloodied and bruised, meet in the middle of the ring immediately after the fight, and they hug each other, and it's the most tender, heartfelt, respectful moment. It's like the most humane moment in like the middle of this just like violent brutality. There's just this beautiful moment of genuine like affection between these two warriors. And so I can see that relationship very easily between Coriolanus and Aufidius.
And there's a respectful parameter to their relationship because they both believe in valor and yes. in reputation.
And they both have it.
So that's the way in which they engage with one another on those terms, which makes it so fascinating when there's this power struggle between them later on. Because I'm jumping ahead here, but Coriolanus criticizes the democratic, the Republican system in Rome for having two leaders, two authorities. He says, when two authorities are up, neither supreme, a gap forms and you fall in between the two. And he says, that's the problem with having the people and the Senate. But then he finds himself in that very situation where you have both Aufidius and Coriolanus trying to lead the Volscian army. And what happens is there's this tension. And there's a kind of rift developing in the Volscians. And Fiennes portrays this really well in his film.
Do you, what is the name of the actor who plays Aufidius in the Fiennes film?
It's Gerard Butler.
Yeah, Gerard Butler. And he's superb.
Yeah.
He's so superb because he's so, he's a man's man. That actor is. And I don't know. I just thought I found him perfectly suited for that role.
Yeah. Because Fiennes shows really well the vulnerability of Coriolanus to be manipulated by his mother.
Yes. Yes, he does. He does. Okay. I want to do two things before we close the show. First, do you see a kind of overlay between Rome and the Volscians? Is it sort of an analogy, an overlay for Athens and Sparta? Is that just me?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Yeah. So we're taking it to a Grecian
parallel. These two sort of social organizations, they seem to me to kind of map onto each other.
It's interesting. I think the word Antium just means other place. It kind of means nowhere. So in the play, Shakespeare's kind of showing us there's Rome and then there's everywhere else. And so in that sense, perhaps the Volscians are not, they don't have the kind of identity that the Spartans had. The Spartans in a lot of ways were, you know, they were superior warriors, weren't they?
Right.
But then I suppose Shakespeare does also give the Volscians their credibility, because otherwise why would Coriolanus be so proud to have won the name of the city of Coriolis? We don't really know the size of the Volscian army population in comparison to Rome. I mean, would you say Rome is Sparta or Rome is Athens?
No, I think Rome just
because
sort
Sparta's
of like
tiny.
Did. Right, right. And so that way, in that way, the analogy breaks down. And the analogy may be overstretched, but I just thought as far as
the
structure of their governance, there were similarities.
We don't know enough about the Volscians, do we? Whether they were kind of just sort of out and out warriors in the way that the Spartans were, that they trained everything in order to go to war. I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
But you're right, in the same way that, that Athens had a superior culture, in a sense, Rome seems to in the play.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk briefly, because I think people are going to be curious to see a production of Coriolanus. If they've listened to this, they are, you know, hopefully going to read the play, and hopefully they'll be able to see a production. So, I'll just start off, Sarah Jane. I think that there's a production of this play by the BBC that was done in 84, which I think is one of, it's maybe the best videoed production of a Shakespeare play that I've ever seen. It is stunning to me. The lead actor is a man named Alan Howard, who he's one of these just incredible British actors that never, I don't know, I think he just never made an attempt to enter Hollywood and make his movie. I just get the impression from Alan Howard, he might be a little bit of a Coriolanus. He was just a purist, you know? And so we don't know his name. The only thing, I looked him up on IMDb, and the only thing that I could find that I recognized was that he was the voice of Sauron in the Lord of the Rings movies, which don't let that pull you back, readers. He's delightful. It's just such a frightening voice. So that, if I could recommend a viewing, I would recommend that 1984, because he is a tour de force. Alan Howard as Coriolanus is absolutely a hurricane. He's incredible. I could watch that film over and over and over. I just find him, I can't take my eyes off him. The entire time I can't take my eyes off him. You and I have both seen a production that was done in the National Theater recently. I saw it via the internet, but you, Sarah Jane, saw it with students live in person. And I was very jealous. Can you tell us anything about that production?
One day, Tim, we'll go to the theatre together in London.
I would love it. Yeah. I would love it.
We'll do that. The Donmar with Hiddleston as Coriolanus, yeah, it was incredible. It's a really visceral production. There was lots of kind of blood and guts on the stage. It's very loud, very raucous, very physical. So teenage boys really loved that, despite their initial skepticism. Really? Do we have to go to the theater?
they wanted to go see a movie.
Said, you will thank me one day.
Yes.
Don't doubt it.
and they did thank you afterwards?
Yes, of course. They knew a good thing when they saw it. And I think Hiddleston is an amazing Coriolanus, because he does have the potential to be a really good politician. There is something charming about that Coriolanus. Yeah. You see, he's just a little bit gentler and more endearing, especially when you see him with Volumnia and Valeria in comparison to Fiennes, who's just kind of really gnarled. And
he's a battle axe.
Yeah, totally.
Fine. Yeah, yeah.
So I like shaved head, scars everywhere. Whereas, older Tony Hiddleston, he just can't get rid of that natural velvety sort of smoothness that he has. So he was excellent, because when he lost his temper, you could see that there really was potential for him to climb down and to be gentler and milder, but that he just couldn't control his temper. Whereas with Fiennes' Coriolanus, you think he's only got one, there's only one gear.
Volcanoes can only produce lava. Volcanoes can't produce cake icing.
Yeah, so the production was fantastic. And I think you said how impressed you were by the magnitude of the action that was able to be conveyed on such a small stage.
Incredible.
Mm.
Incredible. So I think so what I would say to recommend a viewing to our listeners, I think that the Ralph Fiennes version is the most accessible. It's bloody. It's very bloody. It might even be rated R. I don't even know. So if you've got kids in the house, it's probably not for kids viewing. I think it's really good, but it is truncated. It's greatly abridged.
Well, I think that's part of its strength, really, because Fiennes does give it the cut and thrust of a sort of war zone. He chooses Eastern Europe.
Yes.
And that sort of Bosnia-Croatia conflict as a setting to transpose the action to, which I think works really well, because there were all kinds of war crimes, lots of Geneva Convention behavior was completely suspended there.
Right.
It was a totally brutal conflict. And so I think that does capture something perhaps of how raw and violent ancient Rome could be. I think Fiennes is quite canny in that choice of setting.
And by the way, it was filmed. Some of it was filmed in Serbia.
Yes. And they actually did a production of it on President Tito's island in Croatia. They actually, Fiennes performed a theater production of it on a private island off the coast of Croatia. Yeah, because a colleague of mine here at school who's the head of drama was, he was in the play. I think
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember which part he played.
Ask him.
I'll ask him. Scott Handy's.
Yeah,
he's quite
him.
Famous. It might have been Titus Lartius.
Wow.
So that was interesting because it's, again, there's that like sort of political tension.
Yes.
It's not a very successful democracy.
Yes.
And they took the play to an island there and performed it.
Our readers can probably access the Tom Hiddleston play. I saw someone had found it somewhere online, so you can probably access that one. The Alan Howard version from 84, again, that's the high water mark for me. I have had a hard time finding that one online, but if somebody does find it online and they want to post on Facebook where it can be found, I would personally be forever in your debt. I always borrowed the DVD from our public library. So that's how I viewed it in the past. Those are some viewing options for you if you want to dive into Coriolanus. So next week, we are going to tackle Act Two. Again, I just want to say this is just an incredible, incredible play. And I have been looking forward, Sarah Jane, to doing this podcast with you, because we talked off the air about how much we love this play. And we're finally getting to do it. This delightful, bloody, complex play. I'm so glad that we're back on it.
At a time of intense political tension.
Yes.
Globally.
And I can't help but see that this play just really addresses so simple places. I mean, I think for Shakespeare, personality is always politics. It's the personality that drives the politics. But I think this play might be in some ways a subtle exception. He really does, especially in Act Three, deal with the kind of like high-flown rhetoric of statesmanship and the kind of fractures that are inherent in a republic or in a democracy. And that kind of thrills me. I'm going to really look forward to talking to those. Any closing thoughts from you, Sarah Jane?
Well, you know, Tim, I'm a bit of a spotter geek. And I guess our listeners will be reading ahead. And if there are things that they might want to look for, I would suggest they try and find examples of imagery of people and things being eviscerated. There's lots of dismemberment in the play. Blood, imagery of blood. What does it mean that Martius appears covered in blood in Act One? Why is that so significant? And then those two things mainly, because obviously we have this image from Menenius of the body that is whole and functioning at the beginning of the play. And then we see that get torn apart over the course of the play.
Yes.
And anything to do with eating, food, famine, very important in the play. It's it's so brilliant. It's so pathetic to just keep praising it like that without giving reasons. But it really is.
I think we're giving reasons.
And that's the greatest insult, I think, that Coriolanus gives to the people, is that he calls them fragments. He says, you're disconnected, you're irrelevant. If you're not part of the body of Rome, you're basically nobody. Because in ancient societies, you could choose to be executed or exiled, couldn't you? And exile was considered to be worse.
Right.
So by calling the people fragments, he's saying, you're no part of Rome, you don't belong here, you're just irrelevant.
Right, yes. which is a little bit of a foreshadowing to what the worst punishment for Coriolanus might be. It's not death. It's not death.
Well, that's a pretty big hint there, Tim.
Right, and I know it is. Probably too obvious, Sarah Jane. Hey, I'm so happy that you're back. I'm so happy that you and Elizabeth are doing well. It was really nice to see her and hear her. And I'm looking forward to our subsequent shows with you.
I'm really excited to be doing this. I've been enjoying your last two with Heidi as well, though. They've been superb. The Tempest was excellent. That was great.
That play. Gosh, that play. So wonderful. Hey, listeners, remember, you can join the conversation online on Facebook through the Close Reads discussion group or on Instagram and Twitter at Close Reads Pods, and via email by writing to closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. And don't forget about our email newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. And as always, there's always great discussion happening on the Facebook page. Please join us there, the Close Reads discussion page. For Sarah Jane Bentley, I am Tim McIntosh. Thanks for joining us on The Play's the Thing, and happy reading.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.